This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. This is episode 216, and the season is over. And the Cardinals don't have a head coach because they fired Steve Wilks after only one season. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, the USA Today NFL Wire site for the Arizona Cardinals. Co-host is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, the SB Nation Arizona Cardinals site. Seth, we don't have to talk about that game in Week 17. We don't have to talk about the record. We don't have to talk about the disappointment of players or the team. Even though it kind of would be fun to talk about that game. Maybe we'll talk about it some other time because that might have been their best game of the year, especially defensively.
Yeah, and it was their best game in 4 weeks, that's for sure. too little, too late, apparently, for one Steve Wilks. But, you know, it was – you and I talked about this quite a bit. And, you know, the people that listen to this show, they know that I've kind of been – off Wilks as the head coach since about week four, since the what game was that he murdered? Oh, the Seattle game. And I was just like, this, I can't, you know, I'm not a fan of coaches that coach that way. I'm not a fan of coaches that are conservative, that call games scared, or, you know, defensively, if you want to put the, you know, correct terminology on there and whatnot. That's just not how I like things done. So I was never going to be, you know, hip to Wilks and anything like that. And I was ready to move on after one season. I mean, I was ready to move on after week four. And it's unfortunate that it ended that way for him because I think, you know, I think we would agree he's a great guy. He's a guy that really, really believes in what he is doing. Unfortunately, either the players didn't buy in or not enough players bought in that it didn't work out.
So that's what we're going to be talking about in this edition. It's episode 216. This is all about the firing of Steve Wilks and the new coaching search that the Cardinals have undergone. We're recording on a Wednesday night instead of a Tuesday night because of the holidays. So we will go ahead and get that started. We're going to talk about, well, what led to the firing. Was it right? Where the responsibility should be had. We're going to talk about how attractive is this job exactly, since the Cardinals believe it is the most attractive job or most attractive opportunity for a team, for a coach candidate. We're going to look at the four internet. We're going to look at the candidates that the Cardinals have reached out to, the four that are interviewing. And then we're going to wrap up by talking about, well, what do we want? Who do we want to see? What do we want to see? And whether any of the staff that they still have under contract should come back or not. So let's go ahead and get started talking about what led to the firing. And so the press conference comes out. Obviously, we know this team was bad. 3-13, dead last in basically every single offensive category. Dead last in stopping the run, dead last in rushing touchdowns allowed, down to number 20 in total defense. I think they were somewhere between 16 and 20 in points allowed. And so you can't fault the Cardinals for firing, can you? I mean, if you look at it, it was a terrible year. The expectations were higher. They didn't meet expectations, and they failed spectacularly. And it appeared that there wasn't the hope of improvement.
Right, and that's the thing, is you have to sell hope to your franchise. And from a fan perspective, if we take the national narrative out of it, from a fan perspective, I don't think you can sell hope with this team bringing back Steve Wilks. I would say, and I don't know what you think, I feel like it's 50-50 on if there's even hope after retaining Steve Keim. So the idea of retaining both was just, I think it was out of the question. And so despite the national media outcry that Wilks got a raw deal, which I think you and I both agree that he didn't get the best, you know, he didn't get the best opportunity to be successful here, that they had to move on from him. And like I said, I was literally done after week four. Like, I still supported the team. I was hoping beyond hope that I was wrong about him as a coach. It just, you know, it was unfortunate that he is just a guy that was overwhelmed by the moment at this point in his career, and it just wasn't ready yet.
Well, and Michael Bidwill, and interesting is we're going to talk, kind of unpack some of the things he said in the press conference on Monday, is, you know, he had misgivings from week two when they got blown out by the Redskins and the Rams. Now, the Rams thing, whatever, but the fact that they opened the season at home and laid such an egg and then couldn't bounce back with any points in week two, Bidwill said he had major concerns right from the get-go and wanted to give him the full year to turn things around. But I think they realized very quickly that they didn't get it right for whatever reason. And I wrote an article about it based on the comments they said. Basically, Steve Wilks did everything right except for the coaching part, because what stood out on a couple of things that Bidwill said is just how extremely well-respected he was at all levels of the entire organization. We're talking players, locker rooms, attendance. You're talking the front office. You're talking scouting. You're talking to ticket sales. So Steve Wilks was incredibly admired by everyone. He said he's the hardest working coach he's ever come across. Then when he makes the comment, says the performance on the field was unacceptable and the plan moving forward, I wasn't comfortable with. That is a really strange combination to hear, just how absolutely admired he was, and to then turn around and say, I didn't like what he was saying.
Right. And that's, you know, that was just an interesting thing, and it brings into question again what the disconnect was in the hiring process. You and I have kind of hinted, intimated, inferred that the Cardinals didn't get their guy, and I think we know that. I mean, we knew that their guy was Pat Shurmur. After Shurmur turned them down, but you know, was linked to the Giants, what, basically 3 days after the interview process started. And then you got the Mike Munchak thing, which I think was coming from Mike Jarecki, right? Jarecki was really pushing that they liked Mike Munchak, which, I mean, you and I would take as being the number two favorite in that. And
they offered him a second interview, and he turned it down.
Right, and he said, yeah, I'm okay. And so at that point, it was kind of like, all right, we got to do something. And so, you know, it was Wilks. And then, you know, people, a lot of smart football people or writers that I've been reading that have, you know, kind of had a problem with the Wilks firing, one of the biggest things they go back to is that 5-week suspension where he just wasn't around for training camp or the preseason, Steve Keim that being, and that it really just sabotaged the entire first year for Steve Wilks. And I talked to some people, and I mean, it's an entire show in and of itself, but the relationship and the importance of those 5 weeks for a coach and a GM to get on the same page as they are beginning to see what the players on the roster actually have and how they actually fit within the team dynamic.
Yeah. I, for one, as you all have heard me say on the podcast several times, even though Wilkes has been, I mean, the team was bad, Wilkes has made questionable decisions personnel-wise, rotation-wise, in-game decisions, I believe that if you're going to hire a guy and to come in a situation that was, you know, if let's be honest, it turned out that the vast majority of the pundits that predicted what the nailed it. So it's not like the Cardinals outside of the organization, outside of Arizona, surprise anyone. No one expected Arizona to be good. If people expected them to, then they were, I wasn't in the pre, like pre in the off season, were the ones were expected to be a top three pick, right?
Yeah. And Vegas had them as the lowest win total in all of the NFL. You know, most analytics sites had them in the bottom 3 to 5 teams in the NFL. And they're right there. I mean, it's not like they're head and shoulders the worst team in the NFL. I mean, they were really close to, you know, they were really close to Oakland. They were really close to San Francisco, you know, obviously beating San Francisco twice. They ended up being close to the New York Giants. And, you know, both of those or all of those teams, when you look at them, you know, and the New York Jets for that matter, and all of those teams kind of have a lot in common. And outside of the Giants, you know, young quarterbacks or injured quarterbacks, you know, all of that kind of played into the overall aspect of the team. And so, but when you go and look at it too, I mean, two of the top five teams are picking in the top five in the NFL draft. They fired their coaches, right? Three didn't fire their coaches, and the other three either just hired them or they're San Francisco who are dealing with injuries and such to their franchise quarterback or who they hope is their franchise quarterback. So, I mean, it's not like the Cardinals situation was odd outside of the fact that they just decided to fire their coach after one season.
Which, and for one, I believe that if you're going to give a coach a bad situation to get, you really have to give him that second year. So I don't think, like, in terms of philosophically, he shouldn't have been fired because unless they, apparently they believed that this team was much better than it was. And that was the mantra all year. Everyone on the team said, we're a better team than this. Things just didn't make sense. Now, I get why they did it. It's completely understandable. But here's the part that gets me. It's like they didn't know who Steve Wilkes was. No, never mind the fact that he was completely respected throughout the organization. Everyone admired him. Michael Bidwill himself said he admires him greatly. And if you admire someone that much, how can you not be comfortable? Like, they had questions of the Steve Keim talked about schematical questions in terms, especially in terms of defense. He mentioned the problems in all different levels of the defense, the busted coverages in the passing game, the run defense, the offense problems. And then you talk about, you know, they, like he said, I wasn't comfortable with what I didn't believe that his plan would turn us around. What did he sell you on a year ago? Didn't they sign off on this plan a year ago and believe that it would turn this team around?
Yeah, and that's the reality of the situation is that's where my question has kind of, you know, that's where my question of where, what happened that you are that disenfranchised or disenchanted after 11 months. I mean, we're not even talking a full calendar year that Steve Wilks has been head coach. So it takes an awful situation for that to be the case, right?
Well, and even more so is the fact that from the vibe that both you and I got from the comments made, it was made very clear by Michael Bidwill, Steve Keim's job was never in danger. Now, maybe that's smokescreen. Maybe. I mean, here's the possibility, because in that press conference, as you and I talked off the air, it was kind of odd. It felt like Bidwill was kind of covering up for Keim and said, I've got all the confidence in him. You know, when I elevate in 6 years, he did this, he did this. He helped me hire Arians. He built the roster that went to the NFC Championship game. So I have full confidence in him moving forward. So maybe it was smoke screen to kind of deflect from that. But to have it come across and saying that, make it feel like his job was never in danger, when everyone knows that Keim's offseason moves failed. Every single free agent move that they made, every offseason move that they made fell. I mean, they failed spectacularly. His previous drafts, bad. Now, you can say this, the rookie class looks promising, both the draft class and the undrafted rookies. The off-the-street signings that they made had contributions. His in-season moves of plucking guys off the practice squads and things like that, those all seem to move in a positive direction. But the state of the roster is largely on Keim. And to have it externally be, to either defer to Keim to answer all the questions, or rather than basically get up there and defend your guy, it's really weird considering the state of the team.
Yeah, and it's interesting how each, you know, type of situations being looked at separately. And so, you know, Keim is getting a chance to fix this while Wilks is shouldering the blame for the state of the team at this point. And so, you know, we'll see, because that's the thing is we'll get to see if Steve Keim and Michael Bidwill are right, or if they, you know, if they unfairly, or, you know, maybe too soon fired the right or fired the wrong guy. But here's the thing, and I truly believe this. I don't think Steve Wilks would have ever been successful here, because I think he wasn't that first-time head coach type wizard. I think he was a guy that needed to come in and fail before he ended up becoming successful. And he's going to go back and get a defensive coordinator job. Allegedly, there's multiple teams that are already interested in his services as a DC. So, you know, it's not like it's going to affect him in the terms of his career, so to speak. It is a setback in terms of him being a head coach in a short period of time, you know, making that transition from 1 year DC to the head coach. And so now he'll probably put in 2 to 3 years. If those are successful, he'll probably get another run through this. And so we'll see what happens, but it's not like he is, you know, going to go the way of like a Jim Tomasula, where he'll have to, you know, find work as like a ball boy for NFL teams, basically.
Yeah, so with that, we will move on to the next section of the Rise Up C-Red podcast. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about just how attractive this job is, because the Cardinals believe it is the most attractive job. That's coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And let's talk about the attractiveness of this job. They made it very clear. Michael Bidwill said this, that they believe this is the most attractive opportunity out there for a head coach, and listed the following reason. They have a young franchise quarterback in Josh Rosen. They have a talented nucleus of players, which they do. If you look at David Johnson and you look at, we'll throw Christian Kirk in there. Some promise there. You've got Chandler Jones. You've got Patrick Peterson. You've got Buda Baker. Okay. So you've got a talented nucleus. You have, and then he said, there, here's the silver lining, the number one pick in the draft. But not only are they number one at the top of the draft, but they're number one in every single round. They are now have priority. They have number one priority on all waiver claims. So if there's a player who gets waived and they want, they get him. They have a lot of cap space. It's somewhere between like $65 and $75 million in cap space this offseason. And they have, as Steve Keim said, they anticipate 9 or 10 draft picks in this draft. So you look at that and you say, those are a lot of positives, but let's talk about it. How attractive is this job overall? And if you're going to look at the 8 openings that there are, where would you rank them?
I've been doing a lot of trying to research, because I think that's one of the biggest things that you struggle with, as somebody that covers, and you cover much more than I cover. I talk and write about the Cardinals. You cover them more. But when you are a fan and a writer of a singular NFL team, you typically are consumed by that team, right? So you know the ins and outs, you know the roster, you know the 53 man, but then you also know the guys on the practice squad and things of that nature. And so for us, we tend to look at this situation as being not all that bad. That it is a situation where the team can, turn it around quickly and rebound and get back to being a successful NFL franchise by the end of 2019, where, when we have this podcast a year from now, that we'll be talking about the Cardinals getting ready for their playoff matchup. So I've been doing as much as I can to read what others think about all the other situations in the NFL. So not necessarily the Cardinal situation, but other situations, to try and kind of understand where they rank amongst those groups. And I've come away with kind of this as the consensus, is that the top three positions, so it's almost like tier. So tier one is shockingly the Cleveland Browns, the Green Bay Packers, and the New York Jets. The Jets is the hardest one to understand, but then they literally have like $107 million in cap space. And then obviously a top five pick. So like they're not in a bad position. They also have, a young quarterback who they believe is a franchise quarterback. So that's an enviable position, to look at. Obviously the Packers have Aaron Rodgers, which is like a giant trump card to any of these young quarterbacks. Right. And then honestly, the Browns might have the best roster, and Mayfield played really, really well this year, set the rookie TD record. So those are, those are what I would consider the consensus top three. So like the tier one jobs, and then the tier three jobs, or like the worst ones, everything seems again to be a consensus that it's the Bengals. that job is awful. And then
can they please hire Hugh Jackson just to
just for the lulls,
just for the fun? And like, they're gonna have Marvin Lewis and then Hugh Jackson. It would be the most amazing thing ever.
But and so the Bengals are really it. Like, that's the tier three team. And then you get these varying opinions on 4, 5, 6, and 7. And so when I look at it, I think the Cardinals fit nicely into that tier two box. And I think it's just whatever you prefer as your problems over whatever you prefer as your strengths. So when you look at a team, let's say, like the Miami Dolphins, if you're not a Ryan Tannehill fan, then you're going to put them near the bottom, right? You're going to say, oh, like they're the seventh best team. If you look at the Cardinals roster and you go, there's really no talent on offense. Like you literally have David Johnson and that's it. There's not another known commodity on this team because we don't know what's going on with Fitz yet. And even if Fitz comes back, I mean, he's 36 at this point. Like, is he? I mean, he is a very good wide receiver too, but they still don't have a wide receiver one on the roster. And so that's how I look at it. I would say that the Cardinals are in that tier two category. And if you told me that they're the fourth best destination, I would agree with you. If you told me the seventh best destination, you can make an argument for that as well. Like, I don't know where to rank them because obviously all eight of these teams outside of Cleveland are looking for coaches for a reason, and that's because they're bad, underachieving football teams.
For me, I kind of rank them almost the same way. For me, I actually put Green Bay above Cleveland, even though Cleveland did it. But because you have – for me, it's Aaron Rodgers because right. That can be – honestly, that can be a championship team with the right – if the right things happen. And with Aaron Rodgers, he's a championship-type quarterback. So,
and you still have potentially 5 to 7 high-end years based upon kind of how Hall of Fame quarterbacks are going at this point. I mean, you look at Brady, you look at Breeze, you look at those guys. They're playing at a extremely high level into their late 30s and early 40s. And so Rodgers, I believe, is 33. So that's the thing. You're 100% right. Like, if you think that Rodgers is a trump card, then he's literally the best trump card out of any of them.
Yes, yes. And so where you have your tiers, I only put two teams in that top tier, and that's Green Bay and Cleveland. Cleveland, I think what's super appealing about that job is that, yes, Baker Mayfield is everyone who was high on Baker Mayfield. He was my favorite quarterback. It's coming out of last year. It feels affirmation for that the Browns are potentially no longer going to be the Browns, but it looks like they will be a team to compete in that division because you've got Pittsburgh that looks to be on the decline. You've got Cincinnati, which is a mess, and you've got Baltimore. You don't know what to think of them moving forward. And so those two are the top. And then I put at the top of the next tier, I kind of put the Jets and the Cardinals kind of in the same boat. They have more cap space. But yeah, it's kind of like your flavor of ice cream. Which ice cream do you like more? Do you like Sam Darnold more than you like Rosen? Do you like the New York setting more than you like Arizona? Do you like the number one pick instead of the number four pick? That sort of thing. Or number three pick. And so you kind of have that. And obviously, after that, you've got the other teams that are in there. You've got the Cincinnati that's a mess, and Miami I don't think is all that great. Tampa Bay for me is kind of a dark horse because it's how much do you believe in Jameis Winston? If you believe in Jameis Winston, they've got some talent there, and if you can kind of harness that and deal with the character of Jameis, then and the variance that he can offer, then that can be an appealing job as well. I do think though that the Cardinals are an attractive job, but I think now the Cardinals have gotten that Browns stink on them a little bit. The reputation that they had from a long, long, long ago, that it's not the same reputation, but the fact that they were so bad this year and then cut ties with their coach so quickly, it gives them a little bit of that Browns, like, you fire your coach after 1 year, you're the Browns. like, or the one and dones that they had in San Francisco. San Francisco was not in a good place when they went to Tom Sula and to Chip Kelly. And so you're getting that sort of instability. And so while we think it's an attractive job and the things that they talked about are definitely attractive, the problem is, what is the belief in the organizational structure and the time factor?
Well, and so somebody said to me, and I never thought of it like this. And so, you know, I still, you really would have to sell me on the Bengals being a better job than the Cardinals. However, one of the things that people have said is that the Bengals situation is like the complete opposite of the Cardinals. They're going to give you forever to get it right. like you're going to have years to figure it out. And so that's, I mean, if you look at it, I guess from that slant, it makes sense. Again, I don't agree with it, but it's just, it's hard to argue that, like, I don't like the Miami job. I don't like the Cincinnati job personally. You know, I just think, I don't think the Cardinals situation is as bad as it's being portrayed in much of the media. But so in all my research, I don't think I've found them higher than third. And I think that was only one. And I think I found them two or three places last. So the national perspective is that this is, like I said, this is a tier two job right now. And that makes it a hard sell. You know, we didn't even really talk about Denver and their situation where they don't even have a quarterback really that you really, you know, want to hitch your wagon to, right? So you would think, I don't know.
Yeah, that's another, that job is kind of questionable because they're burning through quarterbacks. They're kind of, John Elway has kind of turned that team into, with all the respect that he has and the Broncos has as an organization, it's kind of, they're kind of stuck. Like they got that championship that last year with Peyton Manning. And then the quarterbacks he's hitching his wagon to are really, they draft Paxton Lynch, they go with Trevor Siemian. Now they got Case Keenum. They're all guys, but you wonder about what the plan is moving forward.
Well, and the biggest thing in Denver, and I think it's now becoming a question in Arizona, is not for the head coach, for the head coach, like, what is their timeline? Because it seems like the GMs that have helped put them in the position they are in are basically looked at as not fault worthy, I guess is the best way to say it, right? Like you look at John Elway and his drafts are nothing to write home about. He's really, really struggled since signing Peyton Manning to find any quarterback to replace Manning. He's potentially pissed away one of the better defenses in the NFL. And, you know, and then on top of that, then they traded Demaryius Thomas, Emmanuel Sanders went out. It sounds like Sanders could be on the move. So, you know, it's just an odd situation, but coaches look at that and go, okay, well, Vance Joseph dealt with all of that and still, you know, was able to win games. And then you look at the Cardinals situation and it was like, well, they've only won 18 games the last 3 years combined. They don't have any playoff appearances. You know, Keim, like we started at the beginning, he's built that roster. But he's the one that sticks around. So is same type of thing. Is he a guy that he's not going to get be held accountable the same way that the coach is. So that's, I think that's the one slight concern you have about the whole situation is our coach is beginning to go, I don't want to hitch my wagon to a guy that doesn't have to stay accountable for what the, for what happens.
And we'll wrap up this segment of the Rise of C-Red podcast. When we come back, we're going to talk about the candidates that we know of. There have been six candidates tied to the Cardinals, four of whom, which we'll interview. We'll talk about each of those coming up next on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We're back on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. The candidates, the Cardinals have reached out to six. Now, when the interesting thing is they said they're going to play this closer to the vest this time around, whatever that means. Maybe that means they're not going to announce, I guess what that means. They're not going to do what sometimes they've done in the past or what other teams commonly do is after there's an interview with a candidate, they announce it. This time, they don't really want to tell us anything. Last year, Michael Bidwell, when Bruce Arians retired, said there were three traits that he was looking for. He's looking for a leader. He's looking for a track record of success, different places, different personnel, and then maintaining the culture of accountability. This time, he would give nothing. He gave nothing. We asked, well, what was the type of traits? So like offensive, defensive. So far, what we know, there are six offensive coaches that they've reached out to. Mike McCarthy, Adam Gase, Eric Bieniemy. So we're going to Mike McCarthy, who lost a job at the Cardinals, beat the Packers. Then they've got Adam Gase, fired head coach from the Miami Dolphins. Then you've got Eric Bieniemy, offensive coordinator for the Kansas City Chiefs. Dan Campbell, assistant head coach and tight ends coach for the New Orleans Saints. Quarterbacks coach for the LA Rams, Zach Taylor. And then an interesting wild card is, I don't know when this is scheduled, but former Texas Tech head coach, college ranked guy, current offensive coordinator for USC, Cliff Kingsbury. And there we have our candidates. Mike McCarthy declined. He will interview for other positions. Eric Bieniemy declined. He has four interviews lined up. We see a trend. All of them are offensive guys. And of the three that are the three that they reached out to who are on coaching staffs currently, they are from the top offenses in the league, the top three offenses in the league who are on playoff buys. Make sure that if it makes sense that they would reach out to those guys this week. Mike McCarthy, great career of success at Green Bay. And Adam Gase, another offensive guy, has head coaching experience. Dan Campbell has him head coaching experience as he was interim coach with the Dolphins a few years back. Kingsbury is the interesting one. Let's kind of talk about the declines. Though those two declines from Mike McCarthy and Eric Bieniemy, paired with Mike Munchak a year ago turning down a second interview and Pat Shurmur seemingly more interested in New York than in Arizona, has fans a little bit worried. I will give the it makes sense that they declined, and then you can kind of tell us about, well, there's reason to be concerned. So if we look at it, Bieniemy and McCarthy, there're supposedly some family concerns where he's got stepsons, he's got stepkids that he really loves, and the distance from, like, he's interviewing with the Browns and with the Jets, the distance is more manageable to get back and spend time than the one to Arizona. I'll be honest, I didn't know the distance from here to Green Bay and Green Bay to New York. It's a significant difference. Phoenix is, you know, more than 1,800 miles away. New Jersey is about 1,000 miles away. So that is significant. So that makes sense. McCarthy's a coach that's got a lot of – he's got a reputation. He's the type of guy who will be able to pick his job and should be able to with the success that he's had. Bieniemy, he's on a playoff bye, so he's still technically on a staff. He's got a playoff game to prepare for in a week. He's already got four interviews lined up. And so it makes sense that he doesn't, that he would turn one down, say, you know, my plate's already full. And if he got wind at all that he might not be their number one candidate. And let's be honest, the Rooney rule is a real thing and something that you have to comply with, Bieniemy is their minority candidate at this point. So if you feel like you're just a Rooney interview, and the whole idea of the Rooney rule is to give minority candidates the opportunity. He's already got them lined up. He's got four, so he doesn't need that fifth one. So that's where they make sense. Seth, why should Cardinals fans be concerned?
I think the McCarthy one's a little easier to explain away, although it's still a concern. And that's, you know, he's at the point in his career where he's got enough cachet, where he's built up enough, you know, NFL cred to say, like, look, I don't want to go to, you know, or I want to pick where I go. So in that sense, you know, if he doesn't want to be in Arizona, it makes sense. I mean, it's a, like I said, it's not one of the top two situations, right? Like, obviously Green Bay's one, he was just there, so they're not going to hire him back. And he's interviewing in Cleveland. So he's going to the top situations. Like I said, I think the New York situation is just like, New York's a different animal than anything else. And we talked about that last year with Pat Shurmur of, you know, part of the reason that Shurmur went to New York wasn't that they were that much more talented than the Cardinals. It's New York. Like, it sells itself. It just, unfortunately, it's a reality for, I would say, 90% of people making business decisions in their life, that going to New York is a lot better than going to Arizona. I mean, you and I may not agree with that, but that's just, I mean, that's the majority would prefer to work in that environment, in that atmosphere. The Bieniemy one was a little different. And I think, you know, like you said, if our hypothesis is that he is there at this juncture, their single minority candidate, and the names that are out there. So like you said, there are six names that are out there and he is the only minority. Then maybe he felt, like you said, that he is just getting that Rooney Rule invite. And if that's the case, he's saying, well, I'm going to go to these other places. Like, if I'm going to be the Rooney Rule, I'm going to go to, you know, the places I want to go, or places I should go, or things of that nature. The concern is this: both these teams played the Cardinals this year. Both these teams watched film on the Cardinals, specifically, you know, probably broke down a little film on one Josh Rosen. And so if you're using Rosen as a selling point, is it concerning that two coaches that had, you know, that watched him, that did some work on him in the season, that saw him obviously up close and personal in the season, are saying, no, I'm good. Like, I'm going to take these other interviews. I'm not interested in that one. Like I said, the McCarthy one, if it was just Cleveland, it would make a little more sense. But again, I don't think that the Arizona job is that much worse than the New York job, or is worse than the New York job, outside of, you know, it's New York and not and versus Arizona. So that's the tough one. The Bieniemy one is just, I mean, it's just worrisome. Is there more to it? Is he being, you know, kind of advised to steer clear of this situation? That is, you know, when you make a coach, a first year coach, a one and done guy, it will have a trickle down effect, will it not? I mean, guys within the coaching fraternity will begin to say, all right, I don't know if that's where I want to hitch my wagon, so to speak, right? Like, do I want to go to a place where if I don't live up to whatever their expectations are, that I am going to lose my job in one season, you know, that I won't have a chance to implement what I want to do as a coach? So that's the that's the one concern I think you have from this entire thing.
Let's kind of talk about the different candidates. And the first one to interview was on Wednesday. He's actually reportedly done the interview. We don't know if it's actually done. That's the whole Cardinals keeping things close to the vest. We know that he's set to interview with another team after his interview with the Cardinals
on Friday.
Yeah, so that's going to happen. Is Adam Gase, which is an interesting case because he is a guy, he's an offensive guy, fairly young. He's worked with some quarterbacks, you know, Ryan Tannehill, or, you know, Jay Cutler, gotten some success out of him. He worked with Peyton Manning. So you kind of look at his history. He's been an offensive coordinator. He's got 3 years as a head coach. He started out with the Detroit Lions for 5 years as a scouting assistant, an offensive assistant. He was quarterback's coach in 2007, but that was pre-Matthew Stafford, so he was the quarterback's coach on a bad team. He was an offensive assistant for the 49ers the next year, then the Denver Broncos for 6, coaching wide receivers, coaching quarterbacks, and then the offensive coordinator. Offensive coordinator in 2015 for John Fox, and then was the head coach for the last 3 years in Miami. Took them to the playoffs in their first year, 10-6 that first year, 6-10 and 7-9. Kind of an interesting character. The Adam Gase move was he was supposed to be like the hot offensive guy when he took over for Miami, kind of the guy that would kind of unlock Ryan Tannehill's potential. But he has an under 500 record with him. It's kind of interesting that he, personality wise, can really rub some players the wrong way. And his, I know that there's some players that were not thrilled with him. I think Ndamukong Suh was one who was not a big fan of Gase. There was a player that after he was let go, he publicly tweeted, yes, he was glad that Gase was gone. So there's some interesting things. And then you look at it, as an offensive guy, it's not like the Miami offense was very good this last year. They averaged just under 20 points a game, which was, you know, 26th. They were in the bottom third in rushing, and then their passing offense was not good overall. They only passed for 180 yards a game, so that was, you know, it's the third to last in front of Buffalo and Arizona. And in terms of yards per game, they were second to last. They were the only team they were better than was the Cardinals. So you've got an offensive guy who's got a strong personality that wasn't always likable, and his offense wasn't very good last year. So what do you make it? Because it doesn't seem like he's kind of there. The rumor is that he's their guy that checks all the boxes and then would be the one to like.
Yeah, and he fits a lot of the profile of the coaches that are being looked at this point. That's why he's got interviews lined up for a number of teams, especially teams with young quarterbacks. I know he's not going to Cleveland, but that's partially because he and Jarvis Landry do not get along.
The Cleveland Browns, the other one, Jarvis Landry and Ndamukong Suh.
Yeah, and so the Browns have invested heavily in Landry, so they're not going to bring in a coach that he outwardly despises. I mean, it's different if it's just kind of internal, but when he outwardly voices that he does not like him, I don't think you can do that as a team. You know, the Gase thing is interesting to me. He's a guy that was supposed to be the next, you know, young hotshot coach. I you know, talked to as many people on the ground in Miami that I could that cover the team, you know, in Gase, that are close with players. And the sense there was always that he was a guy that needed to be humbled. And so, you wonder if this firing, if this kind of this situation would be that the answer that they needed or that they said that he needed, which is, you know, to get to the point where he's just maybe a little less arrogant and believes in himself too much. But you and I were talking about this off the air, and it seems a little like that there's a there's an archetype for these guys, and when they're brash and kind of arrogant like that, they tend to fit into the like Josh McDaniels mold, where maybe being the head coach isn't the right gig for them, but when they're able to be kind of restrained by a head coach as an offensive coordinator, they're very successful. We saw the same thing with Dirk Cutter in Tampa Bay, where a very successful offensive coordinator, a guy that has espoused his preference to be an offensive coordinator to a head coach. And so now so is that Gase, or was it just, you know, a situation where he didn't have a ton of talent in Miami? They lost their defensive coordinator, but then they also lost a number of talented defensive players, and then they got really, really old on defense all at the same time. So, you know, that's the hard thing with Gase, is how do you split that up? Like, what do you put on Gase as opposed to what do you put on the situation he was in? I'll say this. If any team looked as bad as the Cardinals the last three games, it was the Miami Dolphins. So, again, I don't know how many people actually followed the Miami Dolphins, and I'm not going to blame you if you didn't, because that's a boring football team to watch. But the Dolphins, after the Miami Miracle or whatever cool little name we're calling it, where they did the laterals, you know, and beat New England 34-33 in Miami. They were 7-6. They were, I believe at the time, either the 6th seed or the 7th seed in the AFC playoff rankings. Now, we all know that the AFC was really competitive, but so they would have had to have finished up really strong to make the playoffs. Now, they went in, again, they have this just huge win over the Patriots at home. The very next week, they go to Minnesota and just get absolutely destroyed 41-17. The next week after that, they host Jacksonville, still clinging to their slight playoff chances. Jacksonville, the Jaguars, and they lose 17-7. And then they go to Buffalo. The season's over. They can't make the playoffs. They've lost that, but they can finish 8-8 in what would have been, you know, a season that many people expected them to be a 5 or 6 win team. And they get absolutely destroyed again, 42-17. So for 3 weeks, they're outscored 100-41, and they're not competitive in any of the games. And that, to a lot of people, was why Gase was let go, why they moved on from him, and they're looking, you know, for another head coach now, is because it seemed like the locker room split, the fact that he had kind of lost the team, not kind of, but had lost much of the team, had just taken to the point where guys weren't playing hard. And so I think that's the negative on Gase, whereas the positive, like you talked about, like, he's a guy that works really well with quarterbacks. I mean, he got a huge game out of Brock Osweiler this year. His schemes fit to what the quarterback's strengths are. He is an aggressive guy. He's a well-balanced guy in terms of scheme and things of that nature. It's just, it didn't work out in Miami for whatever reason. And so is it the Josh McDaniels effect, or was it something, you know, out of his control?
We go to talk about some of the other candidates. I think the most intrigued, probably the funnest one would be Cliff Kingsbury, because he's never coached the NFL. He's had head coaching experience at Texas Tech, and he wasn't particularly great. Now, granted, that's not a huge college program. It's kind of a program that you're going to be a middling team, but he's worked with some pretty dang good, some pretty solid quarterbacks that have went on the pro. So you've got Case Keenum from Houston. You've got Patrick Mahomes. You've got Johnny Manziel. You got Baker Mayfield. He's worked with all of them. His offenses are prolific in college. He would be that one might be fun to see. You know, however, very rarely do you see a coach go straight from college to the pros and be successful on their first gig. But it sure might be fun to watch as the train comes down and blows up. At least it might be interesting and fun to see, especially if you paired him with a decent defensive quarter. It'd be interesting to see what he did staff-wise.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to get a guy that is creative, that is new to the and fresh face to the NFL, and if they could kind of revamp what the Cardinals are as an organization, that's the biggest thing. Is like I won't say I give them credit for even involving them or involving him in this search, but it would be a really interesting way to go about it, because Kingsbury is a guy that is an innovative offensive mind. He's a guy that's going to run concepts to the strengths of his quarterback, and he's done a pretty good job with his quarterbacks. I mean, I know Baker Mayfield transferred, but that's because he had a guy named Patrick Mahomes that ended up taking over for him. So, you know, it's just a situation where it would be a completely outside the box in terms of Michael Bidwill type hire. But we'll see if they'll have kind of the intestinal fortitude, if you will, to make a hire like that, because it is a big gamble in today's NFL to go outside of everybody's comfort zone.
Right. Dan Campbell is an interesting one, because he's never been an offensive coordinator. In fact, he's only ever, like, he was a tight ends coach for the Dolphins and then the interim head coach for the Dolphins before Adam Gase, in fact. His stint as the interim coach wasn't bad. He was 5-7 in those 12 games when he took over for Joe Philbin. And he's kind of the same sort as a leader of men. He was really well liked, very outgoing, got a big personality. But he's worked with Sean Payton now for the last 3 years, assistant head coach and tight ends coach. So he's never called plays, but he's kind of that leader guy. It'd be kind of interesting to see. I guess maybe he'd be kind of this year's Mike Munchak in terms of surprise, but he might be a guy to pay attention to, because he's worked with Sean Payton and comes from that sort of coaching tree. But I don't know much else to think about him other than that he's got head coaching experience for 3/4 of a year, you know, kind of like what Bruce Arians had. But he's not done much else other than position coach.
Yeah, and you look at it in that perspective. As an assistant head coach, he'd be a guy. This is like almost, and I don't want to take away his work as a tight ends coach, because the Saints tight ends are fabulous, and they don't actually draft any in, you know, kind or they don't actually use any type of important picks on tight ends, and they still get really good production out of them, both in the run game and in the pass game. But when you look at it, hiring Campbell feels like, to me, if you were to hire like a Dave Tube or whoever the special teams coach was last year from Atlanta, like that's what it feels like to me, in the sense of they are guys that have experience helping in a number of different ways, that are asked to oversee different things. You know, when he's as an assistant head coach, he does have work to do with the defense. He does work on things with the offense. He does work on things with the special teams. So he's a guy that has a little, you know, he hasn't done direct coaching per se, but he helps put the game plans together on every side of the ball. And that in turn makes him understand the importance and what goes into making those plans each and every week in the game. The biggest thing, and obviously this is everybody, but when you're talking about a non kind of offensive guru type, so, you know, Kingsbury is going to call his own plays. Gase is probably going to call his own plays. You know, guys we'll talk about in a little bit, they're probably going to call their own plays, or they're going to bring in experienced offensive coordinators to do so. Campbell's question is, he's not going to call plays. So who does he get from the Saints offensive tree to call plays for him? Or is there a guy outside of the Saints organization that he has a working relationship with? You know, in the same way, the defensive guy, but I, you know, when you're talking about this hire, this situation, we all know that it really boils down to how they're able to affect Josh Rosen's career and who Rosen is as a quarterback. And so that's the question Dan Campbell has to answer, is not how you're going to help Josh Rosen, but instead who's your staff going to consist of that's going to get the most out of Josh Rosen.
And our last candidate is Los Angeles Rams quarterbacks coach Zach Taylor. Interestingly enough, is a guy who has worked with Campbell on the Miami Dolphins. He was, in fact, Campbell's offensive coordinator that year in 2015 and quarterbacks coach. So he's worked with Jared Goff. He's worked with Andy Dalton. He's worked with Ryan Tannehill. He's been an offensive coordinator twice. He was offensive coordinator in 2015 for the Dolphins and 2016 for the Bengals. But now he's kind of under the McVay, under the whole Sean McVay thing. He's worked with Marvin Lewis. So he's got a varied past. He definitely, he's 35 years old. So he's 6 years younger than I am. So he could be the, like, people would might see him as the next young hot, but the difference is that he hasn't been a coordinator for the last couple of years. And so it'd be kind of interesting to see what he offers, because he doesn't have a big, long career, but he's young. He played quarterback in college. So he could be a good guy to pair up with, say, Josh Rosen. Or potentially, maybe he could pair up, like if they hire Dan Campbell, maybe he's the offensive coordinator.
Yeah, and that's the type of question, is does he fit with that? Obviously, he's worked with quarterbacks. And the thing is this, right? Like, McVay did some play calling in Washington, but it wasn't like Jay Gruden wasn't – that wasn't a lot of Jay Gruden or most of Jay Gruden's offense, right? Like, McVay really did help Kirk Cousins, obviously. I mean, that was his – biggest thing is how he helped develop Kirk Cousins into an $89 million quarterback. But the genius, the in-game genius of McVay didn't really come to light until he got to LA. And so that's the thing with Taylor is we don't know what Taylor is as a play caller, as a guy that's making the on the field in the moment decisions, but we'll see how it all kind of plays out. Listen, when you're if you say these are your four guys, and this is awful, but they have to interview a minority, that's the Rooney Rule, and so, you know, it seems like right now that's just going to be kind of a Rooney Rule interview. They haven't really made a staunch effort in terms of another candidate at this point. I think they're going to probably bring in Jim Caldwell and potentially even Todd Bowles for interviews. But when you look at it, if you're saying these are your four like top candidates, these are the four guys you want. I mean, to me, if you're asking me, I'd prefer to have Kingsbury, like just because of the experience, covering the team, being involved in watching this team and what they become. I think it'd be fascinating. If you're saying like, what's the quickest way to become, you know, a fringe playoff team again, I think it's Adam Gase, because that's kind of who he's been, right? He was in Miami. They're a 6-7-8 win team a year type of team. Campbell and Taylor are really the wild cards. I don't. That's how I feel. I don't know how you feel about that, because they don't have the background that a Gase has, but they also don't have the unbridled excitement that a Kingsbury kind of brings with it.
I agree. Campbell, I think, would be the one that'd be the least inspiring. Gase probably is the safest bet, maybe. I'm intrigued by, I think, aside from the fun that Kingsbury might be, he's the one that scares me the most. And so Taylor's really interesting to me because, you know, you've got some play calling experience. I'm looking at some of those offensive rankings. Miami seeming every year is bad offensively, but you look at the points per game. Yeah. Nothing special from what, but you know, if he can be the next, like he comes off of that Sean McVay will work with under Kyle Shanahan. And so you've got this, that sort of thing. So could he do with Rosen what McVay was able to do with Goff, and what they believe, what everyone believes that Kyle Shanahan could do with Jimmy Garoppolo, because like, look what he did with Nick Mullins. So he is the one I'm most intrigued about. Kingsbury, I'm scared about, because that I think would fail fantastically. And then Gase, I'm like, actually, Gase is the one that I'm like, I don't understand the appeal so much. You're going to hire a guy that was just fired for being bad offensively.
Right. The huge infatuation. Like, it's crazy to me. And like I said, I don't care if they hire Gase. Like, but I think it's funny that that's where they're going.
Right. Maybe there is another candidate in there that's not being that they're actually able to be closer to the vest. Maybe that's already happened. Jim Caldwell, I know, would not excite anyone. Will excite nobody in this town.
But he's also
he might be the most qualified.
Well, and he's also a consistent winner. My problem with Caldwell is just simply like, are we really going to a 64-year-old at this point? Like, I thought the whole idea was to get a guy that could, and not that he can't, but that could mentor and grow with Rosen, where you're saying, like, best case scenario, you're probably only going to want him for, like, 5 or 6 years. I mean, do you really want a coach that's coaching into his 70s that's not Bill Belichick or Pete Carroll?
And then if we're being honest, I think we both would really love Freddie Kitchens. I think,
oh yeah.
I don't know how as a head coach he would be, but I think you could kind of bring back the band. You've got Freddie Kitchens. I don't know who his OC would be. It probably wouldn't matter, but you could bring it. Then it would make sense to have Todd Bowles, which everyone would love. I think that'd be a perfect scenario. Clearly, Kitchens is not on their radar because he would already have been among those interviews, unless he's the, you know, the dark horse in this that they're just not contacting yet.
Yeah, and here's the reality. Like, Taylor, even Gase to an extent, Kingsbury, Kitchens, and you bring in any of those guys, I'm going to be excited. But the biggest thing is, if you bring in any of those guys, you're going to need to make sure that you have a Vance Joseph, a Todd Bowles, a guy that's been an experienced and successful defensive coordinator. I'm not going to say this too loud, but like, what if one of them was going to bring in like a Greg Williams type? So,
jeez.
So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, Greg Williams. Yeah. So it, you know, it's just one of those situations. Like that's my whole thing with it is I feel like there needs to be a solid team in place this time. And I understood that's what they tried to do with Wilkes and McCoy, but let's be honest. Everybody knew McCoy stunk. like you and I tried to spin it as much as we could that it was a okay hire, but the reality from the jump was simply that it wasn't a good hire because he hadn't, you know, again, the vision was to run the ball. He hadn't had a successful running team since 2010. And then his best work as an OC was with two Hall of Fame quarterbacks. It's not like, no offense to Josh Rosen and obviously Sam Bradford, but that's not who he was bringing in, you know, to be his quarterbacks. And so that's the biggest thing. Like, you can't come in with a Zach Taylor, but then, you know, bring in, like a Clancy Pendergast as your defensive coordinator, right? Like it's gotta be a guy that's been successful, that's had continued success in the NFL, not somebody that was in the NFL before, just to be that voice or that old school or, you know, that veteran presence. That's the biggest thing to me.
And with that, we're going to wrap up the show tonight. We're going to see a lot unfold over the next couple of weeks with the Cardinals. Hopefully we hear more of this close to the vest thing, because we're going to hear stuff. Agents, people, that stuff will get out. So it'll be interesting to see what happens coming next over the next couple of weeks. We'll probably have a show next week. We'll kind of look over players and react to the season, unless there's more news about coaching. So that's what we'll do next week. Wrap up this edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. We'll be back again next week. Seth Cox, he's from Reds of the Birds. I'm Jess Root from Cards Wire. Thanks for listening. Go Cardinals. And don't forget to rise up and see red.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise Up Red Sea, Be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up Sea Red.